After the war, and it was Jamaicans and others who went to the United Kingdom to rebuild those facilities. They're the ones who rebuilt it. They're the ones who said, put their sweat, their time, their effort. And what had happened was some of them and some of their children were not properly documented. And quite recently, many of them were deported after so many years of being there. And it was a scandal in the UK. And the Foreign Office had to very, very quickly, because it was heinous. It was hurtful. It was unbelievable, certainly to many of us in Jamaica and the Caribbean who have relatives there from way back as the 1950s and the late 1940s, to recognize that this had actually happened. And that's the Windrush generation. Mm. They were the ones who built.
I want to go back to Prince William speaking in Jamaica.
I strongly agree with my father, the Prince of Wales, who said in Barbados last year that the appalling atrocity of slavery forever stains our history. I want to express my profound sorrow. Slavery was abhorrent, and it should never have happened.
So that is Prince William. And I'm wondering, MP Hannah, if you had a conversation with either him or Kate Middleton, but most importantly, of course, what exactly you're calling for. If you can talk about the whole reparations movement, the CARICOM Reparations Commission that you were a part of a few years ago, what are we talking about here?
Well, you would have seen that I said that I didn't think both Prince William and Prince Charles were very bold or courageous in what they said, because condemnation without action is hollow. And so while we appreciate the royal regrets, which is what I said, it doesn't go far enough. What we would like to see is you condemn something, you say sorry for it, and you say, here's what we are going to do to right those wrongs of history. And what can happen, and Prince William is in a unique position now with where the world is, to look to his leadership of shaping and charting a new, fairer global society, especially for Black people. And he would be remembered for that. So he should take up that 10-point CARICOM reparations plan. Let us look at it. Let us look at the healthcare requests that we're looking at, or suggestions. Let us look at the museums. Let us look at the technical transfer. Let us look at debt cancellation. Let us look, first of all, at the apology. Let us look at the fact that there was tremendous genocide, that was basically perpetrated by the United Kingdom on millions of Black people who came to the Caribbean. Let's start there. It's not only abhorrent. You have to get stronger in your actions. And that's what people want to see. Gone are the days when we would just accept a beautiful speech. That doesn't placate us, because words without actions only offend us. And that's what I think you saw when they came. And I think the Prince and the Duchess need to see this as an opportunity. It was an important trip for them. And rather than see it as a turbulent start, it's just the start. It's not the end of their journey. And they should use this start as a tipping point to shape how they're going to lead in their ascendancy.
Lisa Hannah, we want to thank you so much for being with us, senior member of Jamaica's Parliament. Democracy Now! Has an immediate job opening for a news writer-producer. Visit democracynow.org/jobs to find out more and apply. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
RCT, the In Sound from Way Out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a fresh look at Russia's war in Ukraine through the eyes of our guest, Chris Hedges.
He was a war correspondent for 20 years. He had a show on RT television, which the United States government has blocked. We open up our airways to our friend, Chris Hedges.
We also speak today with Professor Donna Murch, author of the new book, Asada Taught Me, State Violence, Racial Capitalism, and the Movement for Black Lives.
This is an important book. Donna Murch is the historian of the Black Panther Party, and she's got a lot to teach us, as does Asada.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The British Supreme Court has refused journalist Julian Assange's appeal, and he's now in line to be extradited to the United States for trial and certain conviction of espionage. Jim, what was Stella Morris, his companion's, reaction to that decision?
Yes, Stella Morris, who I'm happy to say, and she's happy to say, is now the wife of Julian Assange, did issue a statement upon that ruling. Here is that statement. Just this morning, on our way to school, our four-year-old son asked me when Daddy will come home. Julian's life is being treated as if it were expendable. He has been robbed of over a decade of liberty and 3 years from his home and his young children, who are being forced to grow up without their father. A system that allows this is a system that has lost its way. Whether Julian is extradited or not, which is the same as saying whether he lives or dies, is being decided through a process of legal avoidance. Avoiding to hear arguments that challenge the UK court's deference to unenforceable and caveated claims regarding his treatment made by the United States, the country that plotted to murder him, the country whose atrocities he brought into the public domain. Julian is the key witness, the principal indictor, and the cause of enormous embarrassment to successive U.S. governments. Julian was just doing his job, which was to publish the truth about wrongdoing. His loyalty is to, well, the same as that which all journalists should have, to the public, not to the spy agencies of a foreign power. He published evidence that the country that is trying to extradite him committed war crimes and covered them up, that it committed gross violations that killed tens of thousands of innocent men, women, and children, that it tortured and rendered, that it bombed children, had death squads, and murdered Reuters journalists in cold blood, that it bribed foreign officials and bullied less powerful countries into harming their own citizens, and that it also corrupted allied nations' judicial inquiries into U.S. wrongdoing. For this, that country wants him in prison for 175 years. Now the extradition will formally move to a political stage. Julian's fate now lies in the hands of Home Secretary Priti Patel. This is a political case, and she can end it. It is in her hands to prove that the UK is better than all of this. Patel can end Britain's exposure to international ridicule because of Julian's incarceration. It takes political courage, but that is what is needed to preserve an open society that protects publishers from foreign persecution. The cruelty against Julian is corrupting. It corrupts our most cherished values and institutions. They will be extinguished and lost forever unless this travesty is brought to an end. The fight for freedom will go on until he's freed.
Thank you for reading that, Jim. How can our listeners learn more about Julian Assange and come to his defense?
Very simply, go to Assange Defense, all one word, Assange Defense. Assangedefense.org. You'll see everything that we've gathered there about all of his supporters, about all of the chapters around the country of that defense committee working for his freedom, and how individuals who still believe in freedom of the press in this country and in freedom for Julian Assange can help make that a reality. And now our continuing coverage of Russia's war in Ukraine. Today we take a look at the role the United States and NATO played in Russia's decision to go to war, the fears of a yet wider war in Europe, the peace talks now underway and what it will actually take to end the war, and the portrayal of the war in the corporate U.S. media. Our guest for this topic is Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges spent 20 years as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, where he served as their Middle East Bureau Chief and Balkans Bureau Chief. In 2002, he was part of a team of New York Times reporters who won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of global terrorism. But in 2003, when he spoke out publicly against the U.S. war in Iraq, and the Times then issued him a formal reprimand and told him not to speak out again against the war, he resigned and became a fellow at the Nation Institute. He also hosted a popular and important show on RT television until that network was shut down by the United States. And in addition to his highly heralded Collateral Damage book, Chris Hedges has written a number of other well-received books, including American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America. And in addition to his highly heralded book, Collateral Damage, more recently, Chris Hedges has written a new book, Our Class. Well, Chris Hedges, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Chris, recently you wrote a piece for the Sheer Post where you reminded the readers that, and I quote, "After the fall of the Soviet Union, there was near universal understanding among political leaders that NATO expansion would be a foolish provocation against Russia," close quote. And in that same article, you note that a classified diplomatic cable, obtained, by the way, and released by WikiLeaks, dated February 1st, 2008, written from Moscow and addressed to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, NATO, European Union Cooperative, the UN's National Security Council, and others, made it clear that there was, and again I quote, "an unequivocal understanding that expanding NATO risked an eventual conflict with Russia, especially over Ukraine," close quote. Can you briefly summarize what that understanding was between Russia and the West after the collapse of the Soviet Union, where NATO was concerned, and how that understanding has been dishonored by America and NATO?
Well, first of all, I was there. I was in Eastern Europe in 1989, reporting on the revolutions that overthrew the communist regimes that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And that was a moment of tremendous hope. We thought naively, of course, that with the breakup of the Soviet Union, NATO had been rendered obsolete. Gorbachev had reached out to Washington and to Europe. He was proposing a new security pact, which would include Russia. James Baker, the Secretary of State in the Reagan administration, along with the West German foreign minister, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, along with Margaret Thatcher, all assured Gorbachev that NATO would not be expanded beyond the borders of a unified Germany. The French also made this commitment. And there was this moment when we thought we were seeing a new global order. People began to talk about the peace dividend. The West would no longer, along with the Soviets, would no longer have to pump massive expenditures into their military and weapons systems, including their nuclear weapons systems. And there was universal agreement among even people like Henry Kissinger, universal agreement that an attempt to expand NATO was an unwarranted provocation against Russia, and that it would essentially destroy the agreements and the commitments that had been made, and the possibility of a new world where we had not divided through the Cold War, divided the globe into us and them. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. And you mentioned the WikiLeaks cable, so it was fully understood what this provocation would do. We have to remember that the memory of the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in World War II, which devastated huge swaths of the country, I think 20 million Russians were killed. There's essentially a plain. I mean, it's a flat plain between the Eastern and Central Europe and Moscow. Napoleon, of course, did the same thing a century earlier. And so what we saw was essentially, I believe, the weapons industry, which saw a multi-billion dollar bonanza by refitting the old communist bloc countries in Eastern and Central Europe with NATO equipment. I mean, Poland, for instance, just signed a deal, a $6 billion deal for M1 Abrams tanks. And so the march began. And we have to remember how many countries have been absorbed now by NATO: Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Albania, Croatia, Montenegro, and North Macedonia. And so this was fully understood, and that diplomatic cable, another reason we owe so much to WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, was from 2008. It was written from Moscow. It laid out that Russia perceived encirclement by NATO and efforts to undermine their influence in the region as a violation of the security interests, that they were worried about the divisions in the Ukraine. This is all in the memo over NATO membership, with the ethnic Russian community, of course, against membership, which led to the split, in particular the split in 2014 when we intervened to overthrow a kind of Moscow-friendly regime. The memo predicted violence, and at worst, these are their words, civil war. It said, I'm quoting, "In that eventuality, Russia would have to decide whether to intervene, a decision Russia does not want to have to face." And then it quotes Dmitry Trenin, who at the time was the deputy director of the Carnegie Moscow Center, who expressed concern that Ukraine was, in the long term, the most potentially destabilizing factor in U.S.-Russia relations, given the level of emotion and the quest for NATO membership, and that with Russian intervention, you very well could see U.S. overt, these are again from the memo, encouragement, opposing political forces, leaving the U.S. and Russia in a classic confrontational posture, and that's precisely where we are.
The corporate media's coverage of Russia's war on the Ukraine has been heart-wrenching, bringing the human misery caused by the Russian assault on the Ukraine into all of our living rooms. This is not the case when the U.S. and NATO went into Iraq or Afghanistan. We did not see the U.S. doing to their countries what their and their people, what's being done now in the Ukraine. And we did not see in our TVs their children crying, their homes destroyed. Talk to us, Chris, about the role the mainstream media is playing and what we in America know about the background to the Ukraine war and how it's being fought, and whether Russia is really acting all that differently from the way America did in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, it's acting differently in that it has yet to destroy entire city centers the way we did with Shock and Awe in Baghdad. And I wrote a column also for Sheer Post, picked up by Salon and other places. You can find it on Sheer Post, called Worthy and Unworthy Victims, which addresses precisely that point. The terror that we and our allies carry out, whether in Palestine, Syria, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, Iraq, is dismissed as kind of the regrettable cost of war, collateral damage. We do the same thing Moscow does. I'm not defending, by the way, the invasion of Ukraine. It's an act of preemptive war, which under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression. But Moscow was baited. They pulled the trigger. They're guilty, but they were baited. And so the same thing that Moscow is saying about its military, we say about ours. Having been around, having been a war correspondent for 20 years and been around these kind of massive pieces of ordnance, so the missiles, the 500, 1,000-pound iron fragmentation bombs, mortars, heavy artillery tank shells, belt-fed saws, it is insane to think that once you begin to use these industrial weapons in a populated area, there isn't going to be tremendous amounts of civilian casualties, which is true in the Ukraine, but also has been true in our misguided preemptive wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria. But what the media does is what it always does. It's what the Russian media that's now controlled by the Kremlin is doing in Moscow, but we're no different. So these worthy victims, this is a term that comes from Herman and Chomsky's book, Manufacturing Consent. So what are worthy victims? Worthy victims are Ukrainians. It allows us to paint ourselves as empathetic and compassionate and just. It is used to demonize the aggressor. All our aggressors, like Putin or Saddam Hussein, become the new Hitler. It really is a way of kind of, it's a form of self-adulation. We are good, they are evil. And you use, states use worthy victims to express this kind of self-righteous outrage. And, of course, a very poisonous nationalism. And fact-based evidence is abandoned. We saw this with Iraq. It charlatans and con artists and fake defectors and opportunists, many in the media, become experts that essentially just fuel the conflict. I mean, in that column I write about George Clooney and celebrities who couldn't make trips fast enough to Darfur to denounce the war crimes being committed by Khartoum. I work the Southern Sudan, so I'm not minimizing what happened there. But at the same time, of course, the United States was killing scores of civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they weren't going there. And this is always the case. I write in the column about one of the ironies that happened when I was in El Salvador in 1984 reporting the war. We had a Catholic priest from Poland who was murdered, and this, you couldn't hear about his death enough. And it was used by the Reagan administration to excoriate the Polish communist government. And yet, 4 years before, four Catholic missionaries, American, had been raped and murdered by the Salvadoran National Guard. And the Reagan administration blamed the three nuns and a lay worker for their own deaths. I mean, Jean Kirkpatrick, who was the ambassador to the United Nations, said they weren't just nuns, they were political activists. Secretary of State Alexander Haig speculated that perhaps they ran a roadblock. And then, of course, in Salvador, they had assassinated Archbishop Oscar Romero in March of 1990. That was before the nuns were killed. I mean, by the time, between 77 and 89, the whole period of the Salvadoran Civil War, you had 13 priests killed in El Salvador, but nobody wept any tears over them because they weren't worthy victims.
Well, and following up on that same vein, Chris, the censorship, for example, that has taken place in Russia now, speaking of the media, is something, of course, we oppose, and we can get into our high hats about that, too. The co-founder of WikiLeaks, who you referred to before on that cable that you referred to that was released by WikiLeaks, co-founder Julian Assange, he's in jail in London, where the U.S. is trying to have him extradited back to America and stand trial, where he would face 175 years in prison. What did he do? Well, he was honest enough and honest enough of a journalist to report the hideous war crimes the U.S. committed in Iraq and Iran and so forth. And so, therefore, he has to be silenced and he has to be extradited and thrown in prison and so forth. Am I wrong to raise this matter of what is happening to Assange as we talk about, well, Putin's far more extreme silencing of the press in Russia and also the way the media in this country handles a war by Russia in a very different manner than they handle wars by the United States, of which there have been more of, I might add?
No, the hypocrisy is kind of stunning. Julian Assange never committed a crime. In fact, he's the most important publisher or journalist of our generation, hands down. So I think for those of us who spent 20 years outside the United States, it's all deeply disheartening, especially the way the media has once again served as cheerleaders for this bifurcation of the world into us and them. But of course, we have to remember that this is what the public often wants to hear, because at its core, it's really about us as being superior people. And that's been a pretty hard thing to deliver, given the last two decades of the war crimes that we have committed. And let's not forget that we just shut down RT America, where I had a show.
Yes,
Contact was shut down. Now, I denounced the war in a very fierce post, sheer post that was picked up by Salon and other sites called The Greatest Evil is War. I mean, I, in the first line, called what Putin did a war crime. And that may very well have ended my run at RT. I suspect it probably would have, but they deplatformed RT so quickly that 6 days later it went black. So what, you know, I always tell people if they want to find out why, and RT had a very small media footprint. It's not like it reached, you know, millions and millions of Americans' households. But it gave a voice, as the Director of National Intelligence report in 2017 complained, to third-party candidates, Black Lives Matter activists, Occupy activists, anti-fracking activists. That was their complaint. There's about 7 pages in that report on RT. And while they decry it as a tool of Russian propaganda, all of the examples they cite are about giving voice to dissidents. That has been combined with the use of algorithms to shadow ban people such as myself. That's not conjecture. In the last year that I was at Truthdig, before we all went on strike because the wealthy publisher decided to fire Bob Scheer and opposed our efforts to form a union, the IT people did a graph of impressions. So when you went into Google and you typed imperialism, if I had something recent on that topic, it would come up. And referrals to the site from impressions had declined from over 700,000 to below 200,000. They're probably, and of course, they've managed to erase WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. The whole debacle over the contents in Hunter Biden's laptop, which the New York Post published for 2 weeks, the New York Post was blocked from its own Twitter account, and you had every media organization, bar none, and The Intercept, they were all shouting the New York Times that this was Russian disinformation. I mean, it's interesting that the Times just ran a story on the charges against Hunter Biden, and they went back and actually said that all of the contents were real. None of it was Russian disinformation, but this was essentially, they were doing their job to defeat Trump, the kind of liberal press. And I worry about that, because with a breakdown of standards like that, then all the Trump supporters and all the people on the right go, well, you know, they lie, and they're not wrong. They lie just like we do. The state of the American press is worse than anemic. I've now set up chrishedges.substack.com because Bob Scheer doesn't have any money. I don't have any money. I want to reconstitute my show, which was on Telesur and on Contact, and keep writing my column. But we have been so cornered. I mean, the walls are just closing in a very frightening way. And I think we can't be naive that some of the biggest proponents of censorship come from the Democratic Party, and of course Silicon Valley, which is linked now with the Biden campaign. Now, what gives Google, Facebook, Twitter the right to censor? We know nothing about these people, how they make decisions. They know everything about us. Of course, Silicon Valley pumped out hundreds of millions of dollars. We don't know how much, because it's all, with our wonderful campaign laws, it's all black. It's all dark money. But hundreds of millions of dollars of anti-Trump ads in the last few weeks of the campaign. And of course, the quid pro quo is the Democrats won't break up their monopoly.
Thank you for that, Chris. And before we move on, let me do say on behalf of Julian Assange, if you want to learn more, listeners, about the real life and death struggle of Julian Assange and what it means to freedom of the press, or what's left of freedom of the press in this country, I would encourage you to go to the website for the Defense Committee. It's simply AssangeDefense.org, AssangeDefense.org. Check that out, my friends.
Chris, talk about the no-fly zone over the Ukraine. President Zelensky gave a speech last week to Congress calling for it, and it's a popular demand. Biden so far has said that he wouldn't do it, that it would drag America and NATO into what could be a world war. What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, that is an act of war, because essentially you are dominating the airspace, and if Russia seeks in any way to enter that airspace, they become a target. That's a recipe for war. So people who are clamoring for a no-fly zone are insane. I was at the Veterans for Peace rally in Times Square, I guess it was last week, which was filled with people waving Ukrainian flags and calling for a no-fly zone. I mean, it's kind of like the summer of 1914, with huge crowds swarming out into the center of Berlin or Vienna, clamoring for war. What they were clamoring for was suicidal folly that essentially, you know, took the lives of millions of working-class men for nothing. But I think the military establishment, I mean, who understand that kind of logistics, what they want is Ukraine. They want to turn Ukraine into Chechnya or the old Afghanistan when Brzezinski decided to arm the Taliban and or all these jihadists would become the Taliban and al-Qaeda to destroy the Soviet Union. And that's what we're seeing. So we're seeing staggering sums of weapons pumped into the Ukraine. Of course, the idea is to bleed Russia. But the people who will really bleed in order to achieve this policy decision, of course, will be the Ukrainians. And the fact that the last vestiges of the American left are clamoring for this is, again, a kind of, you know, disheartening window into what's happened to the American political establishment. I mean, the U.S. is now giving $13.6 billion. I think he just gave more in military humanitarian assistance. They gave him $200 million in military assistance. I think they just gave him, I can't remember the figure, another $100 million or something. You have the 5,000-strong EU Rapid Deployment Force being recruited. You see the German government has announced that they will, for the first time since World War II, ship arms to another country. The Germans have said they will now raise their military budget to twice the amount of the old budget, and that they will now raise the defense budget to more than 2% of GDP. And that essentially moves the German military from the seventh largest in the world to the third behind China and Russia, but not China and the United States. And then you have, again, this was an agreement the Clinton administration made to Moscow that they would not deploy NATO troops in these NATO-allied countries in Central and Eastern Europe. That was violated. You have battle groups now with the Ukraine crisis being doubled in size in the Baltic states, I think to more than 6,000 troops, 9,000 troops, U.S. troops in Poland. Battle groups are being sent to Romania, Slovakia. I've covered war, and this is wars. Once you, even if you station troops in a defensive posture, one mistake, one overreach. I mean, we had a missile strike 12 miles from the Polish border. We have Moscow saying that they will attack convoys coming in from the West with weapons for the Ukrainians. I mean, it has you don't control it. Once you open that Pandora's box, it controls you. And history has shown that. And so what we're flirting with here is really potentially catastrophic and not, you know, we can't rule out the possibility of a nuclear confrontation. The more you corner Putin, and just to say about the sanctions are so draconian that they're clearly designed to destroy Putin. That's the goal. And cornering Putin at this particular moment, especially after provoking and aggravating Putin and lying, betraying, that's the right word, this is just folly. But, of course, the arms industry made a fortune off, and they're making a fortune off the Ukraine crisis. Their stocks, indeed, by the way, have all rocketed upwards.
Surprise, surprise. And of course, those sanctions, by the way, which are hurting the Russian people far more than they're hurting the oligarchs or Putin, are an act of war and violation of international law, by the way. But continuing on, and on the notion of some kind of peaceful settlement being negotiated here, from our own media, we simply hear of Russia being very obstinate and so forth and so on. But there have been reports that in a recent round, Chris, of talks between the warring parties, that Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesperson and Putin confidant, said that Russia's war in Ukraine would end in a minute, as he put it, if Ukraine was willing to give up seeking entry into NATO and would let the areas of Donetsk and Luhansk become independent states, recognize that Crimea was now a part of Russia. And apparently when Zelensky of the Ukraine heard this, he didn't reject it out of hand. So what do you see as possible ways out of this, possible ways that this could be settled, what it might mean going forward? And should the U.S. Or China be involved in these discussions of a resolution?
Well, this has been a long-standing Russian demand. This isn't new. And both the Ukraine and NATO refuse to categorically rule out inclusion of the Ukraine. And the Russian request for Ukrainian neutrality is not unreasonable. In fact, I think it's very reasonable. The problem is that Ukraine, in many ways, has become a de facto NATO country because you have U.S. advisors. I think we had 150 advisors in there. It's been flooded with NATO weaponry, and of course that has just been increased with the conflict. And I find the Russian demands, and you go back again to 1989, that era when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was absolutely universal understanding that Russia had legitimate security concerns. You know, it's why the Obama administration, and not an administration I have much admiration for, but they did not ship weapons to the Ukraine. That was begun by Trump and of course, continued by Biden, because they understood that the Ukraine was part of Russia's natural sphere of influence. My father was a cryptographer in Tehran at the Tehran conference for Roosevelt, and that conference laid out gave Stalin that kind of assurance that Allied forces would not move up to the border of Russia. That's what it was about. Churchill and Roosevelt understood, as did the policymakers and diplomats in 1989 and during the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Chris, unfortunately, we're coming to an end to our allotted time. And before I ask you to give our audience again that Substack reference so that people can stay tuned to you, I want to tell you that on behalf of all of us at Law and Disorder, in an act of solidarity with you, our airways are open to you anytime you want to come on. We're totally support you and understand what they're trying to do, and we're here on your side. Chris, tell people how they can get in touch with you.
It's chrishedges.substack.com, and the hope is that I get enough subscribers that I can produce my own show now and continue it independently. But that's really where independent journalists have been left, really appealing to the readers. The model, the corporate model doesn't work. The model of depending on the wealthy doesn't work. It's really in our hands now.
Yeah. Repeat that one more time, please.
It's chrishedges.substack.com.
Well, until next time, Chris Hedges, we so thank you for being with Law and Disorder today, coming on today. And as Michael has said, you're welcome anytime.
Great, great. Thank you so much.
Be well, Chris. Take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.
Asada Shakur is an inspiration to many young black and brown activists today. She was a member of the Black Panther Party in New York in 1968 when FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover said the Black Panthers were the single greatest threat to the internal security of the country. Hoover launched the COINTEL program to eliminate the Black Panthers. When the Panthers broke up, Asada became a member of the Black Liberation Army. She was seriously wounded and apprehended in 1973 by state troopers in a shootout on a New Jersey highway. She was tried and convicted of murdering a state trooper, even though the medical evidence showed that she was badly injured and could not have fired a gun. Asada escaped from prison in 1979, and 5 years later, she was given political asylum in revolutionary Cuba, where she lives today. The FBI has put a $2 million bounty on her head. She has a target on her back, inasmuch as she is wanted, dead or alive. We speak today with Donna Murch, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Professor Murch, who specializes in African American and U.S. history, black radicalism, and history of mass incarceration, is known as the historian of the Black Panther Party. She has recently written the book Asada Taught Me, State Violence, Racial Capitalism, and the Movement for Black Lives, published by Haymarket Books. In it, she analyzes the forces giving rise to black power and black radicalism, mass incarceration, the militarization of the police who target people of color, and the genesis of Black Lives Matter. Donna Murch, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
What is the carceral state and what are its manifestations?
So the term carceral state has really become popular among activists and scholars over the past 10 or 15 years. It was originally coined by Michel Foucault, and the word carceral is derived from the Latin carcere, for prison. But people have chosen the term as a way to talk about broadly the punishment powers of the state. So not just prisons or police, but all elements that would be associated with punishment and imprisonment. That could include the foster care system, social welfare system, a variety of different types of state agencies and functions. So in that sense, the carceral state is an analytic framework that allowed a broader approach to the punishment capacities of the state than just traditional policing and prisons.
Please discuss the origins of racialized mass incarceration and the role Bill and Hillary Clinton played in furthering mass incarceration.
Well, the term mass incarceration, again, I think that we've had a movement inside the university that is very much linked to the organizing outside. And the term mass incarceration has been used for a long time, but only recently, really in the last decade, have historians begun to systematically write about the history of mass incarceration and the carceral state. So generally, this term is used to refer to the early 1970s, when the total prison population, that includes state and federal, begins to rise at large numbers. And it's in the early 70s that the United States prison population balloons and grows many, many fold. The 1990s, under the Clinton administration, Democrats, new Democrats as they call themselves, was actually the single biggest period of increase in the total numbers of people incarcerated in state and federal. So an important concept in thinking about U.S. history is that the development of this mass incarceration system, and I would just add that disproportionate targeted incarceration of populations of color has existed since before even the founding of our republic. So incarceration and racialized incarceration is not new, but it's in the early 1970s that the numbers balloon and just really metastasize. And it's a system that has been built across party. So it's been a bipartisan state-building campaign in many ways, and it was under a Democrat that it expanded the most.
What are the roots of the conflation of blackness with criminality, and how did the war on drugs become a war on black people? What is racial capitalism?
So I think that in some ways we do have to talk about populations of color, because of course Samoan and Pacific Islanders in California have the highest rate of incarceration. We also have very high rates of police killings, incarcerations of Native and Indigenous populations and African Americans. So I think that the overlapping processes in the United States as a settler colonial enterprise that link the seizure of Native land and Indigenous land with the development of African slavery. So I think the deep, deep roots of this system of incarceration is rooted in those overlapping processes in which race is the core foundation. I think it's necessary when thinking about how to organize about against this, it's necessary to think about how capitalism intersects with state functions. And so many of us who are writing the histories of carceral state and incarceration are interested in the process of racial capitalism, which is an argument that both capitalism as a system is built in foundational ways on under race, and that race itself can't be understood without an interrogation of capitalism. The term is taken from Cedric Robinson, who included it in his book on Black Marxism, and he got it from his studies of South Africa and South African activists in the 1970s, who were using this term really in the context of organizing, because they were trying to explain the portions of the Black movement that they found difficult to organize, because in many ways they were benefiting from the extractive nature of the South African economy. And at the same time, the problem of talking about race without a critical material dimension. So it comes actually out of the South African struggle, and Cedric Robinson and peers of his became interested in how do we apply this to the United States and other parts of the world.
For those of you who have just tuned in, we're speaking with Professor Donna Murch from Rutgers University. She's just written the book, Asada Taught Me, State Violence, Racial Capitalism, and the Movement for Black Lives, an excellent book put out by Haymarket Books. We urge everybody to get it. Donna, what led to what you call the extreme militarization of policing, focused on the criminalization, control, and prison warehousing of an entire generation of black and brown youth? What is it, the counterinsurgency campaign against urban protests and black and brown power organizations?
In 1965, with the founding of the War on Poverty, it also had contained within it the War on Crime. And it was a response partially to the urban rebellions. Watts at that time was the largest urban rebellion in history. It was later superseded by the 1992 Los Angeles rebellion. And the state response to this at the local level in Los Angeles was the establishment of the Strategic Weapons Assault Team, later known as SWAT, which became a new kind of policing. All of the first members of SWAT were ex-military from Korea and Vietnam, and it was really taking ex-veterans themselves and taking the counterinsurgency ideas and practices that were being used in Vietnam and other anti-communist wars sponsored by the United States throughout the world, and then applying that to domestic Los Angeles. This concept of this type of policing, and of course the name SWAT, spread across the country, and it became one of the major tools of the war on drugs. So I think at its core, a lot of counterinsurgency practices grew out both of the United States internationalist history of imperialist and anti-communist warfare. There was always a cross-fertilization with what was done abroad with what came home, combined with this real threat and criminalization of mass upheaval. One piece that I would add to that is that this is inseparable from the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement, in which you have in 1965 the signing of the Voting Rights Act And then less than a week later, once we have the legal dismantling of Jim Crow in the South, we have this massive outbreak of protest in Los Angeles. And many people signaled that as the ways in which people were trying to fight these deep economic, material, and structural life of race outside the South, which includes redlining, violent policing, unequal schools, inability to influence local government and shape the community control of education and health.
What was the catalyst for the Black Lives Matter movement that led to the largest mass demonstrations in the history of the United States?
Well, you know, that's a complex question because I think the immediate catalyst, if, you know, we use that if we're talking about a reaction, a chemical reaction, would be the murder of Trayvon Martin and the simultaneous development of these networks of activists that can be traced back to an earlier period, but it was in the summer of 2012 following the acquittal of Darren Wilson for killing Trayvon Martin that we first saw the term Black Lives Matter used. But as historians, we are always looking for the longer histories. And how did this come about? Because, of course, there have been many, many police killings. And why did Trayvon Martin become so central to this? And I think that the 2009 killing of Oscar Grant in Oakland, who was killed by a transit officer in Oakland, that was the first time that I saw this kind of coalition come together in recent history. You can, of course, go back to earlier killings like Yulia Love in Los Angeles or Eleanor Bumpers in New York, and you saw protest. But I think this is really a younger generation of activists who use police killings as a way to understand the diminution of Black life. I also, as a historian of the war on drugs and the Black Panther Party, I also think that in many ways, this emergence of mass incarceration and the total numbers of people incarcerated, the expansion of police powers, the use of asset forfeiture, which incentivized local police departments to prosecute the drug war versus other kinds of crimes, this was an enormous assault on community. And I think it took some decades for people to figure out how to organize against it. So I think even though the Black Lives Matter movement starts with a focus on police killings, I think it is a larger confrontation with this thing that we're calling the carceral state. It's, of course, linked to prison abolition. So I think it has both short and long-term causes.
Donna Murch, the Black Panther Party came out of Oakland, California in the 1960s. You write about the migration of Black people from states like Louisiana to California during World War II so they could find jobs. Please talk about the base of the Black Panther Party coming from several college campuses in the San Francisco Bay Area and then spreading into the community and organizing in those communities.
Yes. Well, you know, the story of the Black Panther Party is really where my book begins. And of course, its title is drawn from Assata Shakur, who was part of the New York Black Panther Party and then the Black Liberation Army. But the origins of the Panthers were different than they were initially thought. They were always described as being the ultimate antithesis to the Southern nonviolent civil rights movement. But the Black Panther Party was actually formed by Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, and a whole generation of young people who were first-generation migrants from the South. They migrated to the Bay Area, largely because of the new opportunities in the defense industry in the 1940s for their parents. And they got unprecedented access to education. Much of it was a problematic education. Huey Newton said that the public education system in Oakland was one of the things that harmed him most as a child. But nevertheless, there was a huge expansion in education and literacy compared to these people coming from the rural South. And many of these young people who had these really traumatic and disturbing experiences in Oakland public schools were able to attend higher education because in California in the post-war period, higher education at all three levels, community college, state, and the University of California was free. So in some cases, people had dropped out of high school, gotten GEDs, and under the California Master Plan, anyone with a high school diploma or equivalency had the right to attend higher education. So the real genesis point from the Black Panther Party was actually in Merritt College, a community college located just on the edge of West Oakland, which was the core Black population settlement of new migrants. And it was there that people began talking and organizing, and they joined a study group called the Afro-American Association. I would add Kamala Harris's parents were also members of the Afro-American Association. And then ultimately, the study group split up. You had a left faction that wanted more direct forms of confrontation, that also thought capitalism was at the core of racial inequality. And it's out of that tendency from the study groups in public education, the urban campuses of both Northern and Southern California, that the Panthers emerge.
Professor Murch, what was the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party?
The 10-point program was drafted by Bobby Seale and Huey Newton in mid-October 1966. And it was essentially a platform for a new organization that called for the right of education for all, for full employment, and also for Black men to no longer serve in the military, and the right of self-determination. The first plank in the 10-point program was the right of self-determination. So it combined, interestingly, socialist goals like full employment, right to housing, and resistance to the military. But it wed that to a program of, at that time, what was called revolutionary nationalism, influenced by Malcolm X, and the right, essentially, of self-determination of Black communities. The Panthers, as they evolve, later repudiate actual revolutionary nationalism. They then become revolutionary internationalists, and then ultimately they repudiate the state system altogether and call themselves intercommunalists because they were interested in ways to create non-statist connections with different communities around the world, especially those fighting on Ho Chi Minh's side in the so-called Vietnam War.
We're talking to Donna Murch, the author of the just-published book, Assata Taught Me. Donna, please describe Assata Shakur's background. She was not from California, but she did go out there. What influenced her? How did she become politically active? And where did she organize? Talk about her apprehension and her trial.
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, one of the things that's really striking is that it's Assata Shakur, number one, who is a woman, two, who's from New York, so the New York chapter of the Black Panther Party, and then the splinter faction that broke off from the Oakland leadership called the Black Liberation Army. So I think that one thing that's so interesting is that it's not the party's founders who have been the real influence for the movement for Black lives today, it's Assata Shakur. She also was a migrant. Her family was from the Carolinas and then migrated and settled in New York. She had similar experiences to those described by Huey Newton and Bobby Seale of experiencing racism in the schools, being confronted with it in New York. And she, too, is politicized while attending a community college. In the early 70s, she was accused of the killing of a New Jersey a law enforcement officer. She was arrested and had multiple trials. In response to this, there was a very strong defense, different kinds of solidarity and defense committees created to defend her. And I teach at Rutgers, which was one of the biggest sites of defense committees for Assata Shakur. Ultimately, she was convicted and was sentenced and then was later broken out of a federal penitentiary and became a fugitive to Cuba. Her autobiography, which she wrote in the late 80s, Assata, has been the inspiration for so many generations of leftists and Black radicals. And that's really my starting point for thinking about Assata Taught Me.
Assata Taught Me, a very great book. Assata Shakur wrote a poem called Affirmation. I wonder if, Donna, if you could please read the short poem affirmation before we have to say goodbye?
Sure. This short affirmation is said at almost all of the different meetings I've attended from different groups within the Movement for Black Lives. It is our duty to fight for freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love and protect one another. We have nothing to lose but our chains.
Thank you very much.
Donna Murch, how can people get in touch with you and keep up with your important work?
Oh, thank you for that question. Well, you can reach me. I have a faculty page at Rutgers that has a link to my website. And the book is being published by Haymarket Press. So if you type in Donna Murch, M-U-R-C-H, Haymarket, the book should come up.
Donna Murch, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Donna.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
whole business of mobilizing people, organizing people, it's got to be right on the top of our radar screen, because that's what's been proven successful throughout American history. If you make a list of all the things that we inherited from our ancestors or forebears, the blessings, most of them started with a handful of people and ended in victory with not more than a few tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. Even the civil rights movement never had more than 1%.
That's Ralph Nader, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Ralph Nader on mobilizing people. Concentrated wealth and power undermine democracy and advance plutocracy. The 1% have inordinate influence over the rest of us. Wall Street dominates Main Street. How do ordinary people break through the oligarchic system to assert their interests over the interests of the super rich? As Ralph Nader says, however we look at it, the wealthy few use the relentless mechanism of commercialism to trample democracy, the natural environment, and the common good. Our grievances are many, Nader says, and the power of citizenship, community, and national pride should be enough to mobilize the population to organize resistance and change. Our guest today is Ralph Nader, the legendary champion of consumer rights. Life magazine ranked him as one of the most influential Americans of this era. Many lives have been saved by his decades-long work. He's helped us drive safer cars, eat healthier food, breathe better air, drink cleaner water, and work in safer conditions. I talked with him on February 17th, just 10 days before his 88th birthday. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I'd like you to talk about a couple of recent articles you've written, Think Big to Overcome Losing Big to Corporatism, and the other one is called Facilitating Civic and Political Energies for the Common Good. And I loved your comment in the Think Big piece. You write, alas, Richard Nixon was the last Republican president to be afraid of liberals.
That's right. He was so afraid of liberals and what he called the liberal press that he put Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a Democrat, as a special assistant, and he proposed a minimum income plan to abolish poverty, which Congress squabbled and didn't pass. He proposed a better health insurance system than Clinton did later. He supported voting rights for the residents of the District of Columbia, and he signed into law the legislation creating EPA, OSHA, the Job Safety Agency, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and it was quite extraordinary looking back on it. He even signed the charter air and water pollution laws, 1972, which to this day we rely on. In other words, there hasn't been a real comprehensive upgrade in the air and water pollution. There have been scattered amendments in the following 50 years. Now imagine a Republican president behaving like that. Well, why was he afraid of liberals? Because he was coming out of the 1960s where there were all kinds of demonstrations, marches. The energy level was on the progressive side, and there was a rumble from the people, and he heard it. And then who knows what happened? The public took all these wonderful advances.